Before saying a word about Mort Kaplan, I want to congratulate Alex Pike and Rachel Sella for organizing this wonderful conference. I had a chance, Vicki and I did, and Lee and Diane Fentress, who are with us, who are graduates of the law school as well, and looked over that magnificent series of panels that you're having. And I admire the fact that so many of the students at the law school are attending those, particularly on a Saturday, and particularly on the day after St. Patrick's Day. This wouldn't happen in Massachusetts. So how they picked that date out and how they got this attendance, Alex and Rachel, well done. So I congratulate you. And I am indeed honored that we have today our David Walker, our Comptroller General, who I understand made a stirring address last evening, and the Honorable Harry Martin, the Chief Justice of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians as well. So we really appreciate their presence here this morning. I'm indeed grateful to Mort Kaplan for that generous introduction. I've always had immense respect for Mort, whether as a law teacher or government official, private attorney or public benefactor. He's made his professional life a continuing tribute to public service and public interest law. Mort has taken his genius for the law and chosen to use it wisely to make an enormous difference. Mort taught me tax when I was a student here. I understand it's not a required course, but I'm sure it's oversubscribed. It was the first course that I ever took in any college or in law school, and it was an open book exam. And I said, well, if it's an open book exam, it can't be all that hard. Boy, was I mistaken. And Mort, no matter what anyone says, you did not teach me to be a tax and spend liberal. It's a little known fact that President Kennedy brought Mort to Washington not only to run the Internal Revenue Service, which was just down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Senate, but so that Mort could keep a close eye on me as well. So it is a special honor to be here in the Kaplan Auditorium as part of the work of the Public Service Center, named for Mort. And let's all do our best to follow his magnificent example of public service through the law. Thank you so much, Mort, and we love you. And we thank Mrs. Kaplan. We thank Mrs. Kaplan for being here with us. Round of applause for Mrs. Kaplan. It's always a privilege to come to UVA and see the law school's vibrant commitment to public service and public interest law. And working together, the faculty, the administration, the students, and the alumni of UVA Law have made it a 21st century model of how a law school can expand the vision of its students and prepare them effectively for a lifelong commitment to public service. Your pro bono program introduces students to the challenges and the very real rewards of using law to help those in need. And your loan assistance programs enable students to avoid the burdensome debt and afford to begin their legal careers in public interest jobs. And your many clinics and courses provide a hands-on introduction to public interest law, including the newest advocacy programs on the elderly, on international human rights, and on immigration. And your public interest law fellowships offer exciting opportunities for experience in service to others through the law. One of the best lessons these programs teach is that there are countless ways to be a public interest lawyer. The example set by another famous son of Virginia, Lewis Powell, showed the difference that early experience in the field can make. As a young lawyer before World War II, he served in the Richmond Legal Aid Society, In 1964, as a leading private practitioner, he became president of the American Bar Association. And one of his first acts was to call for a major expansion of the nation's legal services to the poor. To understand how revolutionary that idea was, you have to know that when my brother became president in 1961, there was no national legal service program. There had long been legal aid and public defender offices in many cities, and a few privately funded groups made poverty law a part of community development organizations, but hardly any taxpayer dollars supported them. In those days, poverty law programs were too controversial for the government to support openly. Instead, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, formed the President's Committee on Juvenile Delinquency and made himself the chairman. Under the banner of fighting urban youth crime, the committee allocated funds in various federal departments to pay for legal service offices in poor communities. In 1964, as part of President Johnson's Great Society, Congress enacted a genuine anti-poverty program in the Office of Economic Opportunity, and under Sergeant Shriver, it became a source for legal services funding throughout the country. That program fills such an obvious need that 5 years later, when the incoming Nixon administration tried to abolish it, the bar and many of us on Capitol Hill were able not only to save the program, but to create the Legal Service Corporation as an ongoing federally funded program. Ironically, President Nixon himself signed that into law as his last legislative act before resigning as president. The attacks on the program didn't stop, however, and its budget and scope continues to be targets. Nevertheless, with the support of the organized bar, it has persisted and even flourished in this state and throughout the country, and a majority of us in Congress continue to support it. There is one other irony to the story. In 1971, when in a battle, President Nixon sought a non-controversial nominee to replace Justice Hugo Black on the Supreme Court, he chose that same Lewis Powell, and the nomination sailed through the Senate, in large part because Powell had proven his dedication to constitutional principles of equality and fairness by his lifelong devotion to the legal services movement. My own experience as a public interest lawyer was quite different from Mort's or Justice Powell's. I began as a political campaigner. Undoubtedly, some of you will also begin your public service in an election campaign this year or in 2008. And perhaps you'll be as fortunate as I was in 1960, and the campaign you join will be a successful campaign for president. I hope some of you will join a district attorney's office, as I also did as a young lawyer. Or perhaps you'll be a public defender or a legal service lawyer dealing directly with clients. They're all inspiring ways to become involved in public interest law and effective ways to learn the practical art of good lawyering as well. I sincerely hope some of you will try for elected office yourselves. If you have the chance, I highly recommend the U.S. Senate. UVA gives you a head start. There were two UVA law graduates in the Senate when I was elected in 1962, Hugh Scott from the class of 22 and John Stennis from the class of 20, both towering figures in the Senate. And 10 more graduates of this school arrived after I did. And there are hundreds more UVAs in public office at every level of government. There are 13 graduates at this law school have served in the United States Senate while I served in the United States Senate, more than any other law school in the country. As senators, we represent our constituents and answers to them on election day. But in a very real sense, we also answer directly to the founders who met in Philadelphia during the hot summer of 1787 and created the kind of government that enables us, despite our many faults, to become the greatest nation in history. The founders were brilliant men who established a constitutional structure that has worked well for 200 years of time and change, war and peace, Pain and Progress. Both that structure, but that structure always has and always will rely on citizens with the courage and commitment to fulfill its promise. They counted on each generation to elect members of Congress who would prevent the executive from abusing its powers. In addition, as George Washington said, the Senate was to be a saucer that could cool the sometimes overheated legislation that might be produced by the House of Representatives. They counted as well on the advice and consent of the Senate to make sure that presidential choices for the cabinet and judicial posts would serve the public interest and not just the president's personal or partisan interests. Rather than the 2-year terms of the House and the 4-year terms of the president, senators were given the stability of 6-year terms, and the terms were staggered so that only a third of the Senate would be chosen in any one election as a way to resist what James Madison called the impulse of sudden and violent passions. The framers also felt the Senate would have the knowledge and skills to make sure the president pursued the national interest in dealing with foreign nations, and thus treaties, vital to a young maritime nation, could not be implemented by the president without our advice and consent. Finally, the framers entrusted the Senate with the ultimate responsibility of serving as the jury to decide whether an impeached president or judge should be removed from office. It's no wonder that many of us in the Senate always have copies of the Constitution readily at hand. And it's no surprise that we keep going back to the Federalist Papers to get new insights into what the framers expected of us. For us, the Constitution is not just an historic document under glass at the National Archives Building in Washington. The status and responsibility that the founders gave us are meant to be applied every hour of every day. We do not have the right to ignore or dilute or waive them because they are not ours to dispose of. They belong permanently to the people we temporarily serve. They are the nation's legacy, and we are the current trustees of that legacy. Our obligation is to see that the legacy is preserved and respected, used in the public interest, and handed intact for the benefit of our successors and all future generations. From the very beginning of my service in the Senate, the powerful force of constitutional principles has been at the heart of my own public service. In my very first year, resistance to the Supreme Court school desegregation cases culminated in President Kennedy's decision to federalize the National Guard to integrate the University of Alabama. 2 months later, the historic Civil Rights March on Washington took place, and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech focused the nation on the fact that litigation alone could not meet the need for progress and basic rights, and that we in that Congress would have to act. In the summer of 1963, President Kennedy sent us legislation protecting those rights, not only in public schools, but also in public accommodations, in employment and voting. Thus began many intense years of debating and testing the constitutional limits of our power to vindicate the basic rights of Americans of all races. Until then, the Senate's record on civil rights had not been a proud one. The same powers and traditions, the same expectation of a carefully deliberation and evolutionary change that enabled the Senate to be a restraint on reckless government, also allowed opponents of civil rights to restrain the pace of needed change. The framers had given the Senate the right to make its own rules, and those rules, favoring lengthy debate, consensus, and caution, in the spirit of the Constitution, also allowed a minority of Southerners to prevent or delay much-needed change by filibustering basic reforms. The Senate became the critical battlefield in the fight for full civil rights and equality of opportunity for all. President Kennedy did not live to see the results of his initiative, but I was privileged to be part of the debate as the Republican leader, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, and our Southern president, Lyndon Johnson, decided that the time had come for long overdue application of the noble principles of our Constitution to all of our people. 71 senators, including 26 Republicans, voted to end the filibuster of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And a year to the day after President Kennedy submitted his proposed legislation, the Senate passed it. And the path towards full constitutional citizenship suddenly opened wide for millions of Americans. The strong support of the Senate ensured that this national course would be accepted by the American people as the law of the land. But that historic vindication of the Constitution was not the only one in my first years as a senator. One of my first speeches in the Senate was in support of Senate ratification of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, negotiated by my brother with the Russians. As the framers foresaw, the nation's strong support for what he called this fresh start on the road to peace was dramatized and amplified by the vote of 81 senators for ratification of the treaty. It's been the same process again and again since then. A Senate designed to be deliberative has proven it can be decisive when needed. And new generations of senators have found ways to meet the challenges of their time within a structure that is hundreds of years old. I think of the battles earlier in my Senate career to abolish the poll taxes, to preserve the Supreme Court's constitutional one man or one person, one vote, decisions on congressional districting, to lower the voting age to 18, to abolish the shameful racism of our long-standing restrictions on immigrants from the so-called Asian Pacific Triangle. I also think of the passionate debates over nominations to the Supreme Court by President Nixon and President Reagan and their rejection by the Senate. There was the intense confrontation with President Nixon over Watergate and his gross abuse of presidential power that led to his resignation on the eve of the debate in the House of Representatives on his impeachment, followed a quarter century later by the Senate's rejection of the partisan effort by the House of Representatives to remove President Clinton through impeachment. But I can remember no time in my life when it has been as important as it is today for the Senate to serve a check on the executive branch. The administration has seized upon the 9/11 attacks and their aftermath to assert powers that no president has ever had and take actions that the Senate must not leave unchallenged. President Bush opposed congressional efforts to investigate the government failures that contributed to the 9/11 tragedy. The administration gave Congress faulty intelligence and incomplete and misleading information when Congress voted to authorize the war in Iraq. The president continues to claim unlimited power to hold detainees indefinitely and incommunicado, and created military tribunals rather than deferring to the courts. He approves policies authorizing torture and inhumane treatment of detainees in violation of federal law, military rules, and traditions. And he refused to come clean with Congress when the facts and the documents began to show the actual abuses occurred. Today, we're embroiled in the debate over the president's claimed power as commander-in-chief of the armed forces to authorize massive, warrantless electronic surveillance of American citizens here at home without complying with the statutory requirement of judicial approval. Together, these and other actions demonstrate the administration's clear rejection of the Constitution's demand for a balance of powers among the branches of government. They suggest an arrogance in the White House that betrays the rule of law that is central to our constitutional structure. The framers anticipated that there might be such abuses, and they expected the Senate to remedy them. As Madison wrote, the Senate must be, in all cases, a salutary check on the government. And in the past 5 years, some of us in the Senate have tried to exercise this constitutional responsibility, sometimes with partial success and sometimes in vain. The White House largely succeeded in preventing serious inquiry on the 9/11 by the Joint Senate and House Intelligence Committee. It refused to turn over relevant documents and provide key witnesses, and the inquiry finally reached its preset deadline. But the congressional and public demand, especially from the Senate, for a thorough investigation continued. And we were able to obtain bipartisan support for a law creating an independent investigating commission. And the 9/11 Commission held comprehensive public hearings and a detailed and thorough report offering at least a partial accounting of the many errors and omissions that contributed to 9/11. That accounting will help us prevent future attacks if we have the will and the wisdom to implement it. We've made much less progress in the complex disputes over the scope of the President's power as Commander-in-Chief. The White House has taken the extreme position that as long as terrorism is involved, the President's inherent powers trump specific statutes and treaties that are the law of the land. This has postured the President as a virtually perpetual war president, since the administration has also said that the war on terror may last for generations. In my judgment, it's a stunning arrogation of power that would have made the founder of this great university, Thomas Jefferson, roll over in his grave. Senators on both sides of the aisle have complained about the White House's assumption that it can detain suspects indefinitely without any judicial review, conduct interrogations using techniques that are classified as torture by U.S. law and international treaties, and turn U.S. detainees over to other nations for torture. In each of these cases, we have asked for the relevant documents. We have urged comprehensive hearings and called for independent investigations like the 9/11 Commission. But we have been effectively rebuffed by a Senate Republican majority that appears more concerned about protecting the president of their party than fulfilling the constitutional mandates to be a check against such abuses. I sit on two of the committees that should be involved in this effort: the Armed Services Committee and the Judiciary Committee. Even when the Republican chairman have been willing to hold hearings on some of these issues, the administration's witnesses have been uncooperative. Again and again, we've been stonewalled, slow-walked, misled on the real stories of these practices, and denied meaningful access to the responsible officials and documents that could tell us what actually happened. On torture, the original disclosures made clear that top military legal offices in the Pentagon strongly resisted the civilian decisions to permit torture, but the civilians prevailed. We knew that the internal debate in the administration had escalated to the highest levels of the Justice Department, the State Department, and the White House. Nevertheless, the administration provided us with witness after witness who portrayed the abuses as aberrations by a few bad apples at the lowest level in the field, a view belied by everything that we have come to know. Military investigations and prosecutions likewise focus on those at the bottom of the chain of abuses involving detention and interrogation. Meanwhile, those at the policy-making end of the chain have escaped responsibility for authorizing and justifying violations of long-standing military rules and statutes that prohibit torture. Many of those officials, rather than being investigated or disciplined, have been promoted and honored. At least two were nominated to federal appeals courts, and one was confirmed by the Senate before his role was disclosed. Another major player became Attorney General of the United States. He took the precaution, just before his confirmation hearing, of withdrawing the key memo at the heart of the torture statute. But he did so only after it had been enforced for over 2 years. After his confirmation hearing, despite his refusal to provide relevant documents and responsive answers, he was approved on a party line vote in the United States Senate. Thankfully, the Senate has not been altogether silent. As John McCain's initiative, we adopted an amendment making clear that torture is prohibited in the interrogation of detainees. After initially opposing the amendment, President Bush praised it and signed it. But when he did so, he hypocritically reserved the right to ignore it in his signing statement, claiming it might interfere with his powers as commanders-in-chief. The same sorry pattern of abuse can be seen on warrantless surveillance. The administration has chosen to tell us very little about their spying program, but the few facts that they have shared with Congress makes clear that the administration is flouting a specific law prohibiting such eavesdropping without court review. When we asked for the legal basis for the administration's program, we got answers, but they were rationalizations that would get a failing grade in any class at UVA Law School. The pattern has been the same on detention practices and on the so-called practice of rendition, the transfer of prisoners to other nations known to practice torture. There has been no meaningful oversight, either by Congress itself or through the establishment of an independent 9/11 commission. The necessary documents are in the files of the executive branch, but Congress refuses to issue subpoenas demanding them. These issues, torture, detention, surveillance, have rightly claimed major headlines of the past few years. But beneath the issues of the day is the issue of a lifetime. Whether Congress will find the courage and conviction to perform its constitutional role. The framers counted on each generation to reinforce our constitutional structure. When we fail to hold the executive to account, that structure is weakened, perhaps permanently. This is a challenge that should concern every American. If the president does not give due respect to the constitutional role of the Congress, and the Congress will not stand up against him when he violates that principle, how can the Constitution be preserved? On such critical questions, it is always useful to consult the wisdom of the father of this university, Thomas Jefferson. A few years before he died, Jefferson reflected upon the democracy he helped create and wrote, "I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society, but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true correction of abuses of constitutional power." Those words rightly place the ultimate responsibility to protect and preserve our constitutional system on all of us here today. As the lawyers and leaders and senators of the future, you have a special obligation to educate the public on these issues by teaching and writing and speaking about them and working with groups that care about these issues. So you have your assignment. Carry it out, and you will join in the great tradition of Thomas Jefferson, Lewis Powell, and Moore Capron, and you will make it possible for future generations here and across the country to confront modern challenges with the help and of an unyielding constitutional framework that has never ceased to and must always protect us all.